First of all, just somebody was asking a few questions about the eight precepts during the interview periods, and please know those eight precepts, you're all expected to be on those eight precepts, unless you've been given special dispensation in triplicate, or just once is enough. But somebody asking about milk and soy milk and cheese and all that sort of stuff, but these are the things which are on the edge. Some people say yes, you can have them, some say you can't have them, and so out of great compassion, you can have the whole lot. So you've got the benefit of the doubt. For the monks, then it's more tough. But this was a question which I didn't have time to read out last night. It's a very nice little statement about some meditation, so I really want to read this out this evening. And it's also to give a few comments about it. It's very nice. Dear Ajahn, I wasn't sure I wanted to share this experience with the rest until I heard a lady mentioned about strong emotions when one reached the jhana. My background, I'm a beginner in meditation, came to this retreat hoping to learn better meditation techniques and sit a little longer with better concentration. I honestly, sincerely did not come hoping for any jhana. I do not want it because I don't think I know how to handle it. The experience, during a meditation session in the afternoon, I saw this experience of white, bright light, like standing on a cliff top and looking up into the sky, all white and bright and very clear. Not so light as in a candle or a light bulb. The strange thing was I didn't know what I saw, because after listening to all the Dharma talks, I did not expect to see this form of brightness. I watched with absolute stillness, I think. That expanse of light grew dimmer and shrink and then brighten up again. During those moments, I just felt good. I watched for a while, not too long, I think, and I told myself, I am letting it go. That expanse of light faded and was gone very quickly. That instant I came out of my meditation and the tears just flowed. I've never felt anything or having any emotions so strong like this. I sat for a while reflecting on this experience and then the feelings came. During those moments I felt warm, comfort, calmness, secure. I went back to my room immediately. This last feeling of security I cannot fathom. I think I let it go because I was afraid, and yet I felt secure. My other sensation I came out of it was the feeling that my neck was being locked. Imagine if you say that this is a figment of my imagination, I would be very happy, because I don't have to think about it at this point when I'm not ready. The good news is I've already decided the next course of action. You heard the song, Que sera, sera. What will be, will be. So to all my new friends here, sorry that I can't say hello, may all of you find your path of happiness, don't have to walk too far, it is right here, and there's a picture of a heart in the heart. Now this is what happens every now and again, people have nice meditations, and we see like lots and lots of nice light. And that's just, the light you see is just the brightness of the mind. When you get still and calm, you calm those senses down, the mind becomes prominent, and the mind is brighter, and that's what you're seeing. You're seeing the mind. And when you see it, you usually see it as a visual image. It's just a lot of beautiful light coming up. And the nice thing about this is that they didn't do anything. They just let it alone, let it be. A lot of times, because it's one's first experience, is perhaps the easiest, because you don't expect anything, you don't know what to do, and because you don't know what to do, you do nothing. You just leave it alone and enjoy it. It's only when you know too much there's a problem. Because then, this is what I should do, this is what I should do. And then you miss the point. After a while, you have to get to know these things sooner or later, because that experience that person had, that hopefully they know enough now not to want it back again, but sometimes you get close and quite almost like automatically you say, oh, this is it, it's coming again, and then you blow it. So this is one of the problems here. What was interesting, that it just brightened up and you felt good, you watched it for a while, not long, you weren't doing anything, with absolute stillness. Yeah, those are all good signs, those are nice limited experiences. And also, the instant you come out of meditation, just tears just flow, because you've got such strong happiness and bliss. Just such strong emotions, and that's one of the nice things about those meditations. It's, this is just so wonderful, so lovely. And I know that sort of one of the first times I got a nice experience, just, you know, the person who taught me it, that teacher, I just wanted to go and hug him or kiss him or do something. It gives me so much happiness. It's just what you feel afterwards. It's very strong emotions. And enjoy those emotions, because there's nothing wrong with those emotions. two types of emotions in Buddhism. There's the positive emotions and the negative emotions. And those positive emotions are the bliss, which even makes you cry, inspiration, loving kindness. Those positive emotions we're supposed to encourage. Some of the negative emotions we're supposed to discourage. The idea of being fully enlightened is not to be like what we call a horizontal mouth. You know, like just having no emotions at all and just being like some sort of vegetable. You know, some sort of bionic monk. It's like, it's more, you know, that when it's all the positive emotions are there in spades, heaps of them. But the negative emotions are no longer there. So when those emotions come, cultivate them. They're good, they're wonderful, enjoy them. This is part of the payoff for coming to a meditation retreat like this. But what was really interesting, you felt secure. And that was really nice, because when you get lots of bliss like that, when you let go of so much, that's when you feel the most security. The less you have, you know, the less you have to lose. If you're so safe and so secure, the least you have. And that's actually is a very nice insight there. What really is security? The more you have, the more locks you have, the more attachments you have, all the more insecure you feel in the world. And that's why our modern age, with all its possessions, is an age of insecurity. Before, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, we didn't have very much. We didn't really worry so much. We were far more secure. But the more you have, the more insecurity you will always feel. So when you let go there, you felt just a beautiful security of emptiness. Sometimes people refer to all afraid of emptiness. When you get into it, oh, it feels so nice. You feel secure, so well done. A nice insight there into the nature of security. That your neck was being locked, that was just because you were a bit stiff for a while, sitting so still, and that's just quite natural, it'll just disappear again afterwards. It's not a figment of your imagination, that's a real experience. It has all the hallmarks of a nimitta experience, not the full jhana, but nimitta experience, pretty close. And you've got the idea, whatever happens, kesara sara, whatever will be, that's the way to go. And you've got a picture of a big heart in the bottom there, because that's obviously the last paragraph there. To all my new friends here, so that I can't say hello, may you all find your path of happiness, don't have to walk too far, it's right here in the heart. Just somebody just saying, just when you ever get nice experiences about that, you always want to share your energy with other people. So they're just wanting to share and make everyone also have a part, or a piece of the action, as they say, in LA. Las Vegas, sorry. So, that's a nice little note there about what happens. So, now when you hear that, please don't feel jealous. it's not fair. Person comes for the first time in this retreat. I've been coming so many times. It's not fair. Because that is jealousy. The opposite of jealousy is this mudita. They have this wonderful word in Buddhism, which means that you celebrate other people's success and you enjoy other people's happiness. Why not other people's happiness? Why not so enjoy it? Say, oh, isn't it wonderful? This is actually the path really works. It's only a matter of time before it happens to you. And then when it happens to you, you can write your little letter and everyone else can enjoy your happiness as well. And that's marvellous. You get inspired by each other's happinesses. But please don't feel jealous. And remember, one of the reasons that person did that is because they weren't expecting it. They weren't trying. They just let it go and it can happen. And that's the important lesson. Get out of the way and let it happen. Any comments on that?
Sure.
Yeah. Absolutely, yes. Because sometimes this is not your first life. Sometimes we think we're a beginner. But you've been doing this many, many times. If you count all the lives you've been meditating, you were all slow learners. Including me. So, many, many lifetimes. And sometimes it just happens that, you know, that something clicks in the mind, there's some sort of resonance with past experiences, and the mind just goes back to some place it's known before. You don't know how you're doing this, but it just happens automatically. You press all the right buttons. You have done it before. And it's almost like a recollection there, of some past peace and bliss, in long ages past, and you're just coming back to your inner home. It's very nice. And if it's been a recent life, when that's happened, obviously you're much closer to it, more able to actually to go back in those places. So yeah, it could be just redoing something you've forgotten. Ajahn Brahm, could you please go over a few of the great questions asked during interviews that have not been covered during the Q&A sessions, so that more people in the group may learn or benefit from them? Perhaps the most difficult question I was ever asked was actually when I was teaching at a school. It was a girls' school, a high school in Perth, and the 14-year-old, question time, said, "Ajahn Brahm, do girls turn you on?" And fortunately, the other girls in the class came to my rescue and said, "Ah, don't embarrass her. Don't listen to her. She's always like this." But that was actually during the meditation retreat. My goodness, I can't remember some of the great questions and answers before, because you know, usually you don't sort of keep these questions and you don't sort of allow too many things actually to be stored in your mind. I sometimes give the simile of my mother's mantel shelf, because my mother, she's still alive, she lives in London, she's got a small apartment, and like most of these houses in England, they were built around like fireplaces, it was very cold. But even though this has got central heating in this apartment block, they've still got like a little fireplace, a remnant of the old types of homes, with a little shelf above. And that's where you put all your photographs and knickknacks and stuff like that. And it's a nice place to put things. So when I first went to visit my mother from Australia, what can you get your mum? We got her a small, you know, the stuffed furry kangaroos, a memento of Australia. And the next time I bought her a kookaburra, the next time a wombat, a koala as well. So they had all these little animals, you know, just thinking of something else you can get her. And I think when I got the kookaburra, then she still had those other little, you know, soft, cuddly toys, which I bought the last time, and other photographs and other stuff. Her mantel shelf was so full, so many things piled on top of it, that when she tried to put the kookaburra on, lots of other things fell off. And so she, you know, tried to put them on again, tried to balance the kookaburra on again, and many things fell off. And I said, "Look, Mum, why didn't you throw some of that stuff away?" "Oh, I can't. Because everything had a meaning, and everything that came from, you know, when my brother went over to Madrid, or that came from when she went somewhere else, and that came from here, and that came from you, and that came from somewhere else." And she had so much stuff on her mantel shelf that it took her a long time to manage to balance. She achieved it in the end. Balance that other gift on top of all the others. And I thought, well, that's what happens with people's minds. That's where I have a nervous breakdown. Just one more kookaburra on your mind. And lots of things fall off. That's called a nervous breakdown. So as a monk, you actually clean off your shelves. If someone gives you a gift, "Oh, thank you very much," you put it on there for a couple of days and you give it away. So that way your shelf is always nice and clean. So you don't keep things over long. What's been said, what's been done, you leave it, let it go. So you don't accumulate things on the mantel shelf of your mind. So that's actually why, you know, the questions of the last retreat, I don't remember what happened in the last retreat, that got cleared off the mantel shelf in my mind a long time ago. So you're nice and empty. And when your shelf is nice and clean, you've always got space there to receive a gift from somebody else. But when you're full, you can't receive anything anymore. So it's nice to be empty. You can always receive something. When you received it, keep it for a little while, then you give it away. To make space for the next moment, for the next gift, for the next act of kindness. So, that's why I can't remember what the other questions were. But I always remember that question from that girl. Okay, next question. Just some comments about what you said yesterday on the Tibetan monks having to go through the test of drying 7 robes. I feel that it's not a form of asceticism, it is as a test just to ensure the monks are ready and can survive in the caves up in the snow-capped mountains. And what I understand is a usual practice for Tibetan monks to go through 3 years of solitary retreat meditating. Hence the test is just to ensure the monks are ready to embark on the practice in solitude and are able to withstand and survive the cold. Actually, when you do go in caves, they're very nice and warm. It's actually outside which is cold. And no sort of, you know, monk, Tibetan Theravada monk or nun in the right mind would go and sit outside in that time of the year. They'd always be out in little caves. And because the caves are covered, sometimes they're covered with snow, they're nice and cozy inside. Because that, the snow insulates them, the cave, if it's a tall deep in the ground, it keeps a constant temperature throughout the year, and they're some of the best places to live. That's where bears hibernate. And the bears know where it's nice and warm. So, and the bears don't have to sort of have any heaters or anything. They're sort of, it's natural. So it is actually in the caves. It's actually quite nice and cosy. But here I think, I'm not quite sure whether this is really true or whether it was just an anecdote or some story somebody made up, but it's a good yarn and I don't mind telling you. Whether it's true or not is beside the point. Anyway, Dhirajan, if we look for happiness in the realm of the five senses, and one of those is eating, does it also follow that how fat we are is how unhappy we are? No. One of the reasons why people are thin is because they worry a lot. It's true. When you worry, actually you can't put on weight. That's my excuse. I don't worry. No, you don't look for happiness in the realm of the five senses, but you look in happiness for... Actually, as a monk or a nun, it's a very beautiful just how you eat. Because, you know, people actually give you things out of, like, kindness and love. And they give the best things to the monks and the nuns. When I first came to Perth, these people would feed us, and they feed us amazing, delicious food. And especially these Thai ladies would come, they'd cook amazing dishes. And then sometimes they'd bring their Australian husbands with them, and their Australian husbands would complain. She never cooks this stuff for me. Only for you monks. And the wife would say, well, you should go and become a monk then. But it's true, I mean, any of you who actually bring dana to the monks or the nuns, it's always something special. And you actually really go out of your way to make it, you know, something special. It's so hard to get ordinary food. It is. It's really hard to get just ordinary plain food in the monastery. It's always something special. And sometimes, and you've done that before, sometimes it happens that I've got to go out early and so I have to make a breakfast because I've missed my lunch. So, you know, the Anagarika makes something. So make something simple. I've never been able to do that. It's always, I've got a chance of making something for Ajahn Brahm or Sister Wayama. And I make it something special. And in a sense, after a while, you understand why. Because, you know, people are kind. You know, they sort of want to sort of, out of gratitude, want to do something for you. So when they actually give this food, it's always with huge amounts of love and kindness. And so it's a joy to eat such food, created with such happiness and such joy. It's much more different than if you went to a restaurant, because, you know, they'd be doing that just to make money. But people offer food to the monks and the nuns, not out to make money, but out of care and kindness. It's a gift of love. Whenever there's a gift of love rather than a gift of duty, it's just really, really wonderful to be part of that. So that's why we enjoy having dana. And sometimes people come to the monastery late and they look up and all the food has been offered. And sometimes it's happened, I've finished eating. But, you know, they haven't taken my bowl away yet to eat. And I say, come on, you can put some more in. And it's not because I want more food, it's because, you know, they've come all that way and they feel so disappointed they almost made it because they got lost or took the wrong turning or somebody was late and they didn't actually make their offering. I remember I did that once. There was a young girl, and I think it was Christmas time or something, and she wanted to offer a card. And I said, oh, do it afterwards. And she started crying and bursting out in tears. And I always remember that. I never did that again. Because she thought that I was actually refusing her gift. And it was only like a six-year-old child. And for her, you know, she made a little card for me especially. She was really excited, wanted to offer it to me. It was only a little card. And I wasn't actually saying no, I said, no, do it afterwards, but that was enough to actually stop. So the whole momentum of giving and love. And I never did that again. So that means people come late and say, okay, here's my bowl, put some more in. And even really, I don't want to eat it. It's just you have to do that, and that's one of the reasons why you get fat, because you're not eating for your own health. You're eating out of this wonderful thing we call like dana, mutual offerings. It's the same with you. If anyone gives you anything, never say no. Because it's an act of kindness and generosity. Someone's offering you something. And if you say no, people think they've gone out of their way, they want actually to give, to let go, to offer. It's an act of kindness and generosity and warmth and beauty. And if you say no, you're killing something very beautiful in the other person. Even if you don't want it, you don't need it, take it. Because they need to give it to you. If you don't need it yourself, you can go give it to someone else afterwards when they're not looking. Okay, the story of my socks. You know, those of you, even in the monastery, you know that I very, very rarely wear socks. Sometimes I wear them inside my hut, but never in public. And the monks will know that. And you know, those people have known me a long time. How often have you seen me wearing socks, even in the cold? But this lady once knitted me a pair of socks and offered it to me on Friday evening before the talk. Here, this is special. I made it specially for you, Ajahn. And so I accepted them. You don't refuse them. I don't say, no, I don't wear socks. Give them to someone else. I accepted those socks and then I put them on for the talk. Now, when I usually sit, I usually don't sit like this. I sit with, like the other monks there, with your feet hidden. And so when I was giving the talk, on purpose, I knew she was actually sitting to my right. I saw her. I checked out where she was sitting at the beginning of the talk. And as I was giving my talk, I sort of kind of moved my robe. And she on purpose. And I was giving my talk, scanning, and I saw at the corner of her eye, because I had a look at her, she said, "He's wearing my socks." And she was so happy. And I was happy too. I gave them away after that, but you know, for that night I wore them and I made her happy. And I did that again about a year ago when I visited a lady who had bad cancer in Melbourne. She actually recovered pretty well, but she was having bad cancer, and I went to visit her to cheer her up because things weren't working at all. You know, you get sort of was it remission, and then sort of the lump grows again and it disappears again. And then it had to go back in the hospital again for more chemotherapy, and the poor lady was just, you know, really just down. So I went to see her, and she wanted to make me a gift, and of course, one of the gifts was another pair of socks. So, thank you very much. I put them on again. And as I went, I wore them out of the hospital, and I checked out where her room is, and I knew that the part way back to the car had to go past her room somewhere. So as I walked out of that hospital, I looked up, got my feet out, and I kicked them up in the air. And I just saw her. I could only sort of see her. I could see her shape at the window there. She was watching. So that made her happy. And why not? So if you get a gift, you know, at least wear it and use it, whatever it is. You know, so within reason, that is. And that way, so you're making people happy. And that's actually why we sort of, the happiness in actually the sharing is one of the reasons. Not really in the five senses, because that sharing happiness is the happiness of the mind. Does that make sense? It's all that generosity giving. It's a wonderful way to live. So, Ajahn, it seems to me that we are constantly being reborn from the moment of conception to the death of the body. Each cell, molecule and subatomic particle is constantly changing, creating preservation and destruction as we move from one stage of growth to another, from one breath to another. I personally can't remember being an embryo, but accept that this was so. I see this constant change as an aspect of rebirth. Please could you comment and advise me whether this is right or wrong view? That's a view which will do. So, not right, not wrong, but it's okay, because we are being reborn every minute. In fact, because Buddhists believe in reincarnation, we are all born-again Buddhists. So, we are born-again Buddhists, and we are born every morning, every moment, so that's a nice way of actually looking at things, because you're completely reborn every moment. Why do we keep carrying all this stuff from the past? Is that really your son or your daughter? If you're reborn in every moment, that was somebody else's son or daughter. Is it really yours? So why worry about them? If you're reborn every morning when you wake up here. When you're reborn, there's no one in the bed next to you. You're single. You haven't got a husband. You haven't got a wife while you're on this retreat. You're single again. When you get back home, you've got sort of your husband and wife waiting for you. But now, you're free. When you wake up in the morning, sort of, you know, you're like a monk on the eight precepts. So when they said the other day, do you want everyone to become monks or nuns? You are monks and nuns for this retreat. Afterwards, you go back to the ordinary life. In that reset sense, you're reborn every morning. And you can be reborn every moment as a different person. So why carry on that old ideas of what you did, what you said, what somebody else did and what somebody else said? If you can use that as a skillful means, you can let go very easily. The jhana you had a moment ago was somebody else's jhana, not yours, because you've been reborn. So you can't say you're a good meditator. All those wandering thoughts, that sleepiness of fantasies you've been doing all the last week. Who did that? If you're reborn in the moment, that's somebody else. That way you can actually let go of the past, let go of the future. If you really could use that as a skillful means, then you can be peaceful. But as long as you are completely reborn in the moment, all that's gone is disappeared. All that's yet to arise is just dreams and fantasies that's not real. The only thing you have is right now. That's a nice way of looking at things. That way there's no such thing as a good meditator or bad meditator. So it's just a way of looking, a skillful means, a nice truth. But be careful there, because some people confuse that and say it's the only idea of rebirth. There is also the classical rebirth, the fact that, you know, you were born from your mother's womb. And that birth also is very important. So you understand that there was a birth before that, a life before that. And that's also very important. So really, we don't really say we're born in every moment. We usually say like re-arising. We use a different word in Buddhism. The word birth is especially reserved for that process where you come into a new life form. You know, like a new body. We usually say like arising and passing away or re-arising. For the idea of like every moment the mind arises again, a new being, nothing going from what went before into this moment. We'll talk about that maybe tomorrow when I talk about anatta, non-self. Anyone comments on that so far? Okay, here we go. Thank you for this morning's talk on insight meditation. You can have no idea how confusing it has been for me trying to find out if this retreat was a Vipassana meditation retreat or not. I asked a few people from Dhammaloka and got some confusing answers and nothing concrete. The problem was that I had been told that the best technique is the Burmese Vipassana insight technique, taught by some in Perth. Also, I thought Vipassana equals 10 days, and I didn't understand what insight was. So I was really pushing uphill, so to speak. And then, because I was only an associate member, I think nearly missed out altogether. Of course, I wanted to do it with you. I now understand a little bit about Vipassana Samatha and also about spiritual one-upmanship. Also, why my books at home that mentioned Vipassana didn't say much. Any comments? Okay. If only they had told me that the opposite, that insight is the opposite of excite. Yes. Yeah, it's true that sometimes there is that spiritual one-upmanship, which is the best meditation tradition. Now, actually, in the Satipatthana Sutta, taught by the Buddha, there is a phrase which says this is, they call it the Ekayana Magga. And Ekayana Magga literally means like one way Dhamma. And some teachers have interpreted that to mean that this is the only way. And because of that, they say, this is the only way, this is the best way, the only way. If you really want to become enlightened, do sort of this Burmese Vipassana teachings. But as many people have pointed out, and you can read that for yourself, is that it doesn't mean that. It means like a way which leads just to one destination. If you practice that way, it only leads to Nibbana. But when it says the only way, the Buddha mentioned actually in very clearly what the only way to Nibbana is. You know what that is? the Eightfold Path. Very classical Buddhism, everyone accepts that. That is the way to enlightenment. That's the only way, the Eightfold Path. And so there's a bit of confusion there. And anyway, as I said, that the Buddha also mentioned Satipatthana. You fulfill Satipatthana by doing Anapanasati, by doing mindfulness on the breath. Satipatthana is not pure vipassana. That's a sort of a furphy. It's not accurate. So understanding that, and get back to, you know, reality and insight, calm, they always go together. And so that you, this is your experience, this is what all my teachers were telling for years and years and years, this is how I understood it, what's said in the sutras, read it up for yourself. So that way that sort of argument sort of doesn't sort of sustain itself. And that people can, when you do this, what's called Burmese vipassana, you get calm, you get peaceful, and people get joy and happiness. They get jhanas even. So they call it one thing, but you're doing the other thing as well. You do samatha retreats, and you get vipassana as well. They both come together. No matter what people call it, if you're practicing the Eightfold Path, then you get all these things happen. So it's like a false distinction. And if you really want to be accurate and bring all these traditions together, so where is the Eightfold Path, then you will find enlightened beings. And then we sort of say, not just Burmese Satipatthana or Burmese Vipassana and Samatha and all these other techniques, what about loving kindness? That's Dinky Dai of Buddhism as well. That leads to enlightenment as well. Said in the suttas, that's fulfilling the Eightfold Path. What about Mahayana? Can you get enlightened with Mahayana? And anyone who really practices Mahayana, they've got to have to do the six perfections. That's what they do, rather than what you believe. If you look at the different traditions by what you believe, then you might get all sorts of arguments and misunderstandings. But put aside what people believe, what actually do they do? And the practice for the Mahayana tradition is to do the six paramitas, spiritual perfections. Three of which are Sila, Samadhi and Panya. In other words, Eightfold Path. So if you're a Mahayana Buddhist and you're practicing those six perfections, I think the other one, I always remember to forget that. No, Wiri is one of them, effort. Everyone does effort. I think Dana is one of them, generosity. Is it compassion? No, I thought it was the other was Kanti. Was it? Kanti, yeah, of endurance, patience. But anyway, just those three main ones, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, that's the Eightfold Path. So people on the Bodhisattva path do the Eightfold Path as well. So it doesn't matter where you think you're going, you're all going to the same place, we do the same thing. You know that sometimes when I get on a plane to go to Singapore, this code share, some people are going on Singapore Airlines, some people are going on Lufthansa. But when you fly in Lufthansa or you fly in SIA, they always go to the same place, even on the same plane. Sometimes people think they're flying Mahayana. Sometimes people think they're flying Theravada. But really, it's a co-chair program organized by the Buddha. We all go on the same plane. In fact, some people go with Vipassana Airlines, some people go on Samatha Airlines. But again, it's another co-chair. So you all understand there ain't no difference. Except, you know, what's said on your ticket, but actually what happens is exactly the same. So is that quite clear to you all? Kosher Buddhism. Actually, you know kosher, those people who fly a lot now, I know all this jargon of all this stuff now, kosher is where you get two airlines share the same plane. Actually, when my mother passed away many years ago before my daughter was born, on two occasions my daughter mentioned that she felt the presence of my mother when she had not even met my mother. That's interesting. We often talk about our mother to the children. If my mother has been reborn, how is it that her presence can be felt by someone who does not know her? Whose attachment is this, the child or my mother? But sometimes that they don't get reborn straight away. Sometimes they can hang around for a while. It's amazing sometimes kids, you know, they are a little bit more psychic when they're young. Bit more open to actually, because a lot of times afterwards we're told not to, or we're told like ghosts are scary. We believe that because all of the films we see about scary ghosts. No, ghosts are the gentlest of people. They've got a very, very bad PR job in our modern world. And imagine being a ghost when no one likes you. You go around to meet someone and they get scared and run away. What would that do? You know, I imagine that many ghosts need sort of therapy these days because no one no one likes them or no one's so scared of them. But as kids, I mean, you don't know better than that. So, you know, sometimes kids can actually quite accept ghosts. So maybe, you know, that mother of yours actually was visiting your children. Felt the presence of her around the house. Why not? I'm not going to go into ghost stories now because it's very dark on the way back to your room. The ghosts are usually very nice. Here I jump on. Hang on. Please could you use your supernatural power to let us experience a little jhana so that we can understand what you mean when you talk about jhana? Well, what do you think I've been doing for the last 7 days? Using the psychic power of instruction. Why is it that everyone wants the easy way? They want someone to do it for them. They want, so come on, give me some sort of pill. Give me an enlightenment pill or a jhana pill. Actually, some of you thought of actually, you know this virtual reality stuff where you can actually put this little helmet on, right? Imagine you're getting like a virtual limiter coming up with a virtual. That might actually work, and then get this virtual limiter coming up in front of your eyes. But that was being silly, because these things are born of letting go. Even if you had the virtual limiter there, you wouldn't be able to get into jhana if you hadn't done the letting go. You get all the keys there, but you haven't sort of got this ability to put the key in the hole and turn the door and turn the lock and open the door. All letting go. So you can't actually force it. You have to do the letting go. No one can do it for you. Go on.
There's a gadget I had about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
This one is widget things from the States. They had a frequency and I looked into it and it looked just like a limiter.
Yeah, yeah.
And I looked in it and I just went into it.
Yeah.
And I just went and I actually just passed out, and I had a headache for 2 days.
Really? My goodness.
That's what I got, a headache for 2 days.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you've got a big bill as well. So anyway, we'll leave that one alone. Dear Ajahn, is it okay to get the stick out and hit the water buffalo now and then? I'm in a lot of fantasy and chit-chat, doing nothing. How about a little corny joke? What is... Oh, no. Okay, yeah. I know. What is brown and sticky? Answer the stick. Yeah, the corny joke, never mind. Is it okay to get the stick out and hit the water buffalo now and then? I'm a lot of fantasy and chit-chat doing nothing. No, the Buddha said, put away the stick. That's actually what he said in the Dhammapada. Everyone fears the stick, put that away. Because you're conditioned for doing that. And otherwise, the only time you do anything is when someone hits you. And then you'll be just this, you know, really dummy who's always looking for someone to hit you to do something. You've got to take responsibility for yourself. So, instead of using the stick, using willpower, using, you know, punishment and all that sort of stuff, instead of that, we should start looking at the encouragement and wisdom. Wisdom power is much more important. So don't use a stick, use a microscope. Use the magnifying glass. Find out, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? So look at why do you get into fantasy and chit-chat doing nothing? So a lot of times it's because not enough happiness, trying too hard, expecting. So just follow the instructions. And if you follow the instructions and then do the right thing, you don't need to have a stick to hit yourself. All you need to do is just follow the instructions and it works. This is an old path, a well-worn track, which people have been walking along this Eightfold Path for 26 centuries, even before then, in previous Buddha eras. It's well-worn, it works, all you need to do is to follow the instructions. But sometimes we don't pay attention to the instructions. In the same way that still many people, they might get a new fax machine, or a new microwave, or a new video recorder, and we plug it in, and then it goes bang. And it's only afterwards, when things go wrong, do we read the instructions. By then it's a bit too late. It's much more fun, much better to read the instructions first of all, and then plug it in. Unfortunately, we meditate without reading the instructions, and things go bang. In other words, we fantasize, we dream, we get frustrated, because we don't follow the instructions. Read the instructions carefully. And especially, look at that relationship between you and all those thoughts and fantasies and dreams. You need to hit yourself, that's more controlling. Look at that relationship. You're dreaming, you're thinking, you're chit-chatting. There's you watching all of this. What's connecting you between those two? And if you actually look at that, you see so much areas where you really do the work, and there is where you learn meditation. That's where you train yourself. Sometimes it may be ill will towards yourself. Oh, I'm really hopeless. And so you want to be punished. But that just makes more ill will and guilt. So there's no punishment in this retreat. Michael, even in the monastery, some weeks ago, one of the Anagogas did something really, really stupid. And so I said, right, that's it, I'm going to break my rule, I'm going to give you a punishment. I'll give you 50 strokes of the cat. I did, 50 strokes of the cat I gave him. We've got a little cat in our monastery called Kit Kat. He had to stroke it 50 times. That's what I call 50 strokes of the cat. I think you've heard that one before, otherwise you might have laughed. But the reason I did that, because the person wanted punishment, they had no compassion for themselves or anybody. That's a big problem there. Now, punishment, I've done something wrong, because they don't know what compassion and forgiveness is. So they have to learn compassion by finding our monastery cat and stroking it softly 50 times. And that's what compassion is. So that's actually a punishment, not really a punishment, but it was an exercise which actually solved the inner problem. So, if you want a stick, why do you want a stick? Whoever wrote that just needs to find a kitten and stroke it 50 times. In other words, be kind to yourself and be kind to others. Allow yourself to be, accept. Oh, I've got a wandering mind. Be kind to it. Allow it to be. And then you'll find the wandering mind will stop. If you hit it, you'll go on further. Anyway, next question. Ajahn, if you remember your past lives but you do not gain stream entry, who do you think you are? The previous person or this person just with some new memories? Or whatever. E.g., if I was John in a past life and Mary in this life, would John think he is now in a new body, or would Mary remember her past life as a man? Or something like a movie, and not really connected to who she is now. Actually, just reading a little article by Ian Stevenson, who said that's a lot of times what happens when people have got some cross-gender identification. Men who feel they're sort of women in a men's body, or women who feel they're men in a woman's body. And they say it's because they've come very recently from a previous life in a different gender. Sometimes that makes a lot of sense. However, most people, if you do cross the genders, that very often you soon get used to your new gender, because it's only just like changing from a Toyota to a sort of a Honda or a Nissan or something, just different car, you soon get used to it. And people who do remember their past lives, if they have been a previous gender before, they just take it as part of the course and they just identify with their present gender in this life. At least they know all this thing. You aren't a woman, you aren't a man. All this men-women business, that's just on the outside. No more than you are a Toyota because you drive a Toyota car. Or you're a Ferrari because you drive a Ferrari car. Just because you've got an expensive car doesn't mean you're a great person. So, it's just a body, that's all. So after a while people stop identifying with that body. And then, it doesn't matter sort of what vehicle we've got to drive this lifetime, whether it's a Singaporean-made vehicle or Sri Lankan made vehicle, or made in England vehicle, or made in wherever vehicle. So it doesn't matter what vehicle is made, all the same engines. So that way, that it's true that you can cross genders, but you may just have a bit of difficulty when you're very, very young, but you soon identify with your new gender. That makes sense. Okay, next question. Ajahn, please enlighten us. I've been trying all week. I saw a red flower during my meditation and then it fades away after becoming pink. Aha, this is very nice. This came to me yesterday after tea time when I had a more solid meditation. And after I sat under a tree after lunch, I came into the hall and had the image. Oh, I had the image. Yeah, okay. So this sometimes happens, that when you get a powerful mind, or the mindfulness becomes strong, then things mess around in your so-called solid world, things start to change. The walls start to melt and become like chocolate dripping down. You see holes through those walls. You see the wall, the solid floor start to wobble like waves on an ocean. Things start to disappear. Stars in the sky, some of them don't come down and greet you. You start to see just the trees just opening up to the world inside. You don't go crazy, just the perception is allowed to play around. The mind is becoming strong. And all of the blinkers, these things which horses wear to stop them seeing too far to the left and right, are all taken off and you've got your perception takes wing. It's good fun to do that, but it's only fun. You don't get too enlightened doing that. All you do is just have a bit of fun. You're experiencing what the mind can do. And that's quite good. I call that like, you know, meditation playtime. Many teachers actually say never get involved in that, never do such things. See, they call it just wasting time. You don't go crazy, it's just wasting time. But I say, look, you work so hard and you get a bit of a paycheck here. Just enjoy it for a while. You know, you've got some weird experiences. It makes you sort of think you're getting something out of this retreat. You haven't wasted your money. It's something nice to tell other people. Hey, guess what I saw during this meditation retreat? It's weird, and weirdness is fun. So it's okay to indulge for a little while. It's a bit of playtime. It's like watching a video or a movie. But don't just spend all your time doing that. After a while, come back, make the mind peaceful and still. So when the perception does really get strong, you see beautiful images rather than fancy things. But it's good. See a red flower become pink. Maybe become black, maybe just disappear altogether. It's interesting when those things happen. My question is about Nirvana. I heard somebody saying some time ago that eventually every being in this universe gets enlightened at last. They say even Buddhists, villains like Osama, like Devadatta, will be a fully enlightened Buddha in the future. Is that correct? Is there hope for me? I added that one. Is that correct? Please explain. Actually, Ananda asked that question. He said that's a silly question. You can't actually say that 50% or 30% or 100% of beings will become enlightened. What's important is, will you become enlightened? So, enlightenment is there on the menu, but will you take it? Are you willing to let go, to have all that bliss? Are you willing to walk out of the jail? Or is your jail a bit too comfortable? You're attached to your jail, you're familiar with it. Have you got the guts to see things in a new way? Insight takes courage. A willingness to know the truth no matter what happens. A lot of people are willing to put away the known to find out the truth. Amazing, just how we're attached to our comfort zone. Because what we know already, okay, it's painful, at least we know it. The one story I read in a book some years ago about this man in the United States, must be about 30 years ago, because this was concerned this fellow called Ram Dass, this like American hippie guru figure, about 30 years ago. You know, long hair, beads, all that sort of stuff. Went to India for a year and got a lot of interesting experiences and went back, wrote a book, became a guru and quite famous at the time. And one of his little students, her father was very, very sick in hospital, in great pain. And she thought, I'm going to take my guru to go and see him. Maybe my guru, this American Ram Dass, can do something. And so he took, you know, this long-haired sort of hippie in, you know, orange robes or whatever, sort of into the room. And the father, being like a redneck, said, get that idiot out of here. You know, didn't want to hear anything about this, Indian Eastern stuff. This was 30 years ago. But he was interested in talking with his daughter. So his daughter sat down beside him and had a chat. And Ramdas, not knowing what to do, decided, oh, I might as well give this guy a foot massage. But he was massaging the guy's feet. And then the guy stopped talking to his daughter and said, leave my swearing feet alone. Because what had happened, the pain had disappeared. And even though the pain had gone, and he was without pain for the first time in weeks, he'd rather have the pain than have the pain taken away by some guru figure in robes he didn't really understand. Because it challenged his views too much. When I heard that, I thought, this is very, very interesting. We'd rather have pain and be in our comfort zone of views than have our views challenged to have a relief from pain. And that's actually how a lot of us, we don't want to be free. Because it's okay, it's comfortable, it's pleasurable, it's blissful, but it challenges us too much. It challenges our views and the way we look at the world. That's why the views, ideas, is one of the biggest sticking points. What we're attached to. That's why we'll fight wars on our views. Who's got the right religion? We'll fight to the death for our views, but not to get rid of pain. Interesting, isn't it? Anyway, you said everything is conditioned. The question here is, if I go to a supermarket and pick up the thing which I never heard and never seen before, is that also conditioning? Yes, it's conditioned by the talk I gave yesterday. If I hadn't given that talk, you would not do that. If not, what is that? Anything to do with cause and effect? Could you please make more clear about condition and cause and effect? Yeah. There's always a reason for that. You decide not to pick up the usual thing because I said so. Would you talk about now we can apply the principles we have learnt on this meditation retreat to our lives in the world? Thanks. Oh my goodness. There's still how many days to go? 2-3 days? 3 days, is it 3 days?
Two and a half days.
Okay, 2.5 days, that's 60 hours. That's 3,600 minutes. That is, was that quickly? 216,000 seconds. You've got 216,000 moments to become enlightened. 216,000, that's light years away. So, it's a long way to the end of this retreat. And anyway, don't you remember the story I told at the beginning of this retreat? During the interviews, people have told me just how wonderful this retreat is and how much they're getting out of it, that maybe we can keep it going for another week. So cancel all your plans to go home. Give me all your tickets back to Singapore. I'll sort of rearrange it for another week. No. So you don't know what's going to happen in the month. And I'll probably teach the last talk on a Saturday, think about how to look after this mind and body in the world. But you're not in the world, you're in this retreat centre. So don't run away too fast. A 9-day retreat, don't make it a 7-day retreat by ending now and start making all your plans for what you can do when you leave here. We wish too many moments of our life away. Even when I was a school teacher, one of the fellow school teachers, he wasn't really happy being a school teacher. He got a job as a tax inspector. And he got that job about 6 months before the school year finished. And he told me one day, he said, you know, I just found myself wishing away 6 months of my life so I'd get out of here and do something else. And that really shocked him, because 6 months is an awful lot of your life to wish away. And said, even 1 day or 2 days is too long to wish away. So why do we keep on wishing away days, years of our life? When I get this out of the way, then I'll be happy. When I get this retreat out of the way. You started thinking what you're going to do when you leave here? Don't be silly, because you're wasting time. You may never get out of here. So leave that alone. Dear Ajahn Brahm, since your talk this morning, I've become aware of the defilement cravings that come up when I am deep breathing meditation. Now obviously what is stopping me from going further, is that right? Quite likely. Any tips on how to deal with these in meditation as they arise, and also in everyday life? Okay, what happens is once you see them, seeing them is 99% of the problem. Because once you see them, you see exactly what's happening, it's very easy to stop. Once you see where the switch is, you can actually turn it on and off. It's finding where that switch is. That's the hard part. And all those switches, they lie in that gap between the one which is watching and what you're observing. How you're watching it. The switches don't lie in what you're observing. It's not a problem about wandering mind, anger, whatever. That's not the problem. The problem is what you're doing about it. That's where you do the work. That's where the switches are. So if you're angry, you're at peace with being angry. And then you turn off the switch of anger there. When you've got defilements, cravings coming up, you don't watch the craving out there. You watch what's doing the connection between you and the craving, the object of the craving, the wanting it. That's where you do the work. Once you see where it is, you can let it go very easily. That's where you do the work. That's where the cravings exist, and that's where they're stopped. The space between that which knows and what you are knowing, how you're knowing it. So you do that, and then eventually you can stop everything. Girajan, Mahayana monks and nuns practice in chanting mostly. Do they obtain insight through chanting? I don't know. It's not exciting anyway. That's certainly not our chanting. It's not exciting. So if it's not exciting, it must be inciting. Maybe. I know our chanting. I know that monks use our chanting to scare away ghosts. We do it. The monks are the best ghostbusters, Buddhist monks. When everything else fails, they usually call in the Buddhist monks to scare away the ghosts. And the reason is because our chanting is so bad. Not any self-respecting ghost just can't stand here and run away somewhere else. Not more that Buddhist chanting. Ah, it's just a ghost who runs away.
Buddhist choirs.
Oh yeah. Yeah, maybe the case. Not monastic ones anyway. But yeah, that's how we scare ghosts. A choir comes along and scares the ghosts. Do the same insight through chanting. It's not really, I suppose, not really the great insight. But if you do the chanting and then stop, and that's very good. So you do the chanting and then stop and listen to what happens next. Then you get peace, and that's very important. So listen when the chanting stops. And that's a good place for insight. Next question. Ajahn, as you were saying after your retreat, you saw this bamboo so beautiful and lovely. Is that mean that after this retreat I will also see my girlfriend much more beautiful and attractive? And I said, like, during the retreat I saw that bamboo, and after the retreat it looked really ugly. I'm not saying that to be so that's what I said. Does it mean, if, actually I think, of course, many sort of divorces and sort of separations have been cited in a recent ordination. I won't tell you who it was, but one of the anagogues who became a novice, and his girlfriend came to the ceremony at Noramara. And you know these novice ordinations, many of you have been to them, and everyone there was just so happy, had big smiles on their face, except this one young lady. So I soon figured out that that was his girlfriend. I really felt sorry for the poor girl. But anyway, does it mean even that the big pimple on her nose will be the most beautiful pimple in the world? I was also thinking that I should send my girlfriend to some of these retreats so that she could tell me that I'm the most happy. That's a very good question. There we go. Last night, when people asked about psychic powers, it reminded me of a story told by a Sri Lankan monk in India. Okay, this is nice, the story. One day, the Lord Buddha was waiting to cross a river with some young monks. A homeless wanderer with psychic powers also came to cross that river. Instead of waiting for the raft, he walked on water and went to the other side. So the monks told the Buddha, "Venerable sir, you have more powers than that man. Why do you not also walk on water and cross that river?" And Lord Buddha asked the boatman, "How much did it cost to take one man across the river?" The boatman said, "One penny." So the Buddha turned to the monks and said, "The value of that power is only a penny." That's very nice, isn't it? I never heard that story before. Very good story. So crossing the river is only worth one penny. Imagine these days if you could actually, and if you did have levitation, you wouldn't need actually to go on the jet to go to Singapore. But imagine the problems you would get when you land. Immigration. And what flight did you come? I came on my own flight. Imagine if Al Qaeda could do that. Anyway, dear Master, what is the made up component? What is the made up components of the stream of consciousness? At its purest form, without being tainted by defilements, does it still exist? Two, you're only supposed to have one question each. What happened to the stream of consciousness upon enlightenment? Does it still exist outside the realm of rebirth? Three, is everybody's stream of consciousness the same as its purest form or as its true nature? One, two, three questions now to find out the answers to those three questions. In a couple of days' time, we're going to be talking about the seven paths of enlightenment. So this is a trailer for a talk coming in the theatre near you. In a couple of days' time, then you will have the answer to those questions about enlightenment and the stream of consciousness. The stream of consciousness is answered tomorrow in Anatta, non-self. And a couple of days' time, the day after tomorrow, we'll have about what happens when you become enlightened. Where does that stream of consciousness go? All be revealed the day after tomorrow. I thought it was going to be the last question. Oh my goodness, sorry about that. How does Buddhism explain or account for such misfortunes as poverty? It's not a misfortune, poverty. Wonderful being poor. It's like, how you're poor. Famine. You're not eating in the afternoon. That's famine. Natural disasters. Your meditation. How do you account for those things? Right, you haven't been following instructions. And people born with debilitating disabilities. Now, sometimes that these are very often their karma, that we have these disabilities, or that they have natural disasters, families, problems. Not always karma, but very often there's karmic cause there. But whatever it is, this is what we've got to work with. As I was saying, it's not the poverty, not the famine, not the natural disaster, not the disability, but how we relate to that disability. And as many of you know, there's some amazing people who have had terrible disabilities, but they've been the most wonderful, happy, fulfilled people. And the reason is because the relationship with that disability has been incredibly positive and wise and compassionate. They haven't tried to get rid of the disability, they've made use of it. Accepting, working with, contentment, giving, expecting nothing back in return, not expecting it to get better. In the same way, the person with a disability comes to terms, accepts, and transcends their disabilities, so our disabilities of our meditation, the natural disasters when everything goes wrong, is how we look at those. That's how we learn how to meditate well. It's the old karma, you know, the disabilities in your meditation, but what you're doing about it now is the karma you're making in the present moment. Whatever you're experiencing, you can always make something of it. Even the most deviant sexual fantasy, you can let it go, be at peace with it, and you find it turns into the most blissful state of meditation. How do you deal with it? There's the key to meditation. Don't deal with it with greed, hatred and delusion. Deal with it with letting go, freedom, peace, and then you find everything just turns. People like Angulimala, the serial killer, hearing the teaching of the Buddha in a few moments, a few days, became fully enlightened. You could turn it that quickly. Crazy people like Patachara became a great teacher, the Arahat Bhikkhuni. This is what one can do. It's not the thing in itself, not the great problem you have, but how one looks at it. And there one works. That's how to deal with the poverty, famine, natural disasters, and debilitating disabilities, which sends you to your bed because you're so tired and debilitated you can't meditate anymore. So if that's the case, please disable yourself and go and have a nice sleep. And hopefully I'll see you again in the morning, because they'll be born again every morning for another day. And who knows when this meditation retreat will end. Tomorrow's another day. And I was going to say in the retreat. No, I could not say it's like it is a big trouble. So have a nice night. No, I can't say that. You take all the bad karma. No, I can't. No, I said the retreat isn't over until the fat lady sings. I wasn't meaning Sister Wayama sitting next to me. But someone's going to think that, and I'm going to get into big trouble. That's why I try to stop myself. He takes the karma. That's the other Australian saying. You really got me into a bad karma. Go and have a rest of your life. Okay. See you in the morning, if I'm still alive. That's fine.